It's 15 minutes after midnight, and I'm joined on the line by David J.W. Bailey. He's talking to us all the way from outside of London in the UK. David, thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to discuss any growth business anywhere in the world.
Absolutely.
So, I really enjoyed the first part of your show and introduction.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. We've decided that on a Thursday morning, we do want to interrogate some of the things that entrepreneurs need to be thinking about. And one of the things that we've been talking about is, how does one create a business that is global in character, even though it has a regional root? Yeah, but how does one scale your business in such a way that it has appeal globally? And I understand that there are different types of businesses that have different characters. But I suppose in a general sense, how does one start thinking in those terms and drawing on your experience, David?
It's a genuinely interesting question. The first place I would direct anybody is to look at things that are growing and scaling naturally.
Yep.
So look at the very big forces in the world which tell you what's happening. So a simple one, the population of the world is aging. So things that appeal to the older population are likely to grow globally.
Yep.
That's probably one of the more simple ones. If you're very technical, you could look at something like artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
But I'd like to use the advice I always give entrepreneurs is, find a rising tide to put your boat on.
Wow.
And
okay.
That's the very first part. So find something that is growing anyway and go there. You can't force growth. Well, you really can't force growth. You can throw a lot of money at it. But if you're an entrepreneur, we tend to work on companies that are growing themselves through their own efforts, rather than, say, a global marketing campaign. So they have to find every part of advantage, every small advantage they can get to help them grow, and find a rising tide. Sell something that is selling into a growing market,
yeah,
whether that's the elderly or hunger or changes of lifestyle, or if you're very smart and it's a rising technology, 5G mobile phones, artificial intelligence, Internet of Things.
I remember somebody.
We wish to scale.
Yeah, I remember somebody saying to me that the one business that you can always be sure is going to grow is the funeral undertaking business. Or the business of toilet papers. But I don't see that kind of business growing in the kinds of exponential ways that I suppose entrepreneurs would be looking to see, you know, to see the that kind of growth. Is that the kind of business one should be looking at in terms of stuff that's needed, stuff that's growing, stuff that has a wave, or is that perhaps a bad example to use?
Perhaps toilet paper is a little simple, but if you take an aging population and you looked at healthcare for the elderly, or communications for the elderly, or transport for the elderly, as you put your head around those problems, I think you'll see that they will scale and grow globally.
Yep.
Japan showed us the way with the change in their population. Africa has a very, very young population, yep, on average, but it is still aging. It is shifting, although we know the tragedy of AIDS taking out a whole generation,
sure,
of young people.
Yeah.
That is already being reversed.
Yeah.
So if you find a service that older people want, add perhaps a little bit of magic, a little bit of technology, then I think you're looking at a business that will grow globally very fast.
Give me a call, 011-883-0702. David J.W. Bailey is my guest. He's an entrepreneur and a business advisor out of London. We're talking about, how do you create a business that has global appeal? One of the things that he's saying is that you need to look at a business that is on a wave that is growing. You need to look at world trends and find the trends that are growing, and perhaps lock yourself into that sort of stream. What sort of business are you involved in that you want to get involved or that you want to globalize, as it were? Give me a call, 011-883-0702. Give me some examples from your experience, David, that that have perhaps eluded most people. When the business started, it looked like it was dead in the water, but because of the principles that you've just explained now, found that that business actually grows, not only grows, but has the kind of global appeal that we're talking about.
There are some absolutely cracking examples that sit sort of just below the radar in the world. One I can think of provides links between hospitals and old people's homes. It's a thing that I particularly like, serving the elderly population. That business showed spectacular growth. And I tend to work with people. So these aren't businesses I own. These are people that I work with. So that's one. As another example, entertainment is a very fast-growing space. People in the developed world have more time, so they spend it on entertainment.
Yeah.
And if we look at the 25-year rise of games on mobile phones, which were dismissed out of hand, when, if you remember back to the first versions of Snake on your very first Nokia phone,
yeah.
See the progression of that. Now, that progression was apparent to very few people, when it first occurred. Most people went, this is silly, that will never be a business, and now it's a $40 billion worldwide business. So those are things that sort of elude other people, but were driven by great trends in free time.
Yeah.
So there's a couple. And there are more, the one that always causes arguments in the bar is things like Uber or on-demand taxis. Are they really what they say they are, or are they going to be replaced by something else in the developed world? But no doubt at all, driverless vehicles are part of that wave, taking people out of employment and replacing them with robots.
Sure.
It's a terrifying thing for populations, say, in Africa, which has a surplus of labor.
Yeah.
But in the rest of the world, I think, especially in Asia, that trend is unstoppable already.
Is there a particular mindset that the entrepreneur needs to have that would facilitate the ability to spot those kinds of trends that you're talking about?
Wish it could be taught.
that's the question I was going to ask. And can it be taught? Is it duplicable?
I think it can. I think 40-odd years of experience and working with some very interesting ultra high net worth individuals around the world, with startup businesses all over Africa, Asia, America, Europe, I think there is a thing which is an almost childish delight in learning.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to express that better.
No, I get what you're saying. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, so it has to be a natural curiosity that doesn't necessarily follow the rules, almost, if I understand you correctly, David.
Yeah, what I find is that the great innovators, who are not necessarily brilliant entrepreneurs are innovators with business skills as well, but the great innovators have this childlike love of learning. They cannot help but learn all the time. They're open to new things, but they are aware of and tend to follow 95% of the rules. So don't break every rule.
Sure.
That just causes trouble. But one or two rules may not help, and perhaps you find a way around them, or you don't break them, you just find a better way. I've worked a little bit with a sub-Saharan African food producer using satellite data and sensors to reduce insect damage on crops.
Yeah.
And the rule they broke was, well, this should all be done with complicated regulation. And actually, they just sent text messages on phones to local farmers and said, there's a lot of locusts. Do something.
Sure, sure.
So they took a set of rules and technologies and mixed them up and made something very, very effective. So, yeah, childlike learning with observing most of the rules.
Most of the rules. 011-883-0702. Are you an entrepreneur? Are you thinking about having global presence? Is your business in a particular, I suppose, global trend or maybe even regional trend, right? And you're thinking about having your business in other parts of the world. What are some of the considerations, David, just in terms of regulation internationally that that business people need to be thinking about if they want to have a business presence globally, I suppose?
Well, I mean, you can employ an army of lawyers and they would only get halfway through that topic. If only we had a good set of international regulatory rules that were the same. We just don't. We are very lucky in that Europe has one set of rules which are very powerful and quite easy to understand. They're very well publicized. You can read them. And a company formed anywhere in Europe can trade anywhere. We can trade pretty easily with the US. The US can trade fairly easily with us. Slightly more difficult into Japan and China, but still quite easy. What I would suggest is find yourself a good lawyer. And there are many advisors who will provide a little package to create your first sort of seed in one of the major jurisdictions. But I would say there's no harm at all in having a branch that just branches from a South African company. It's a perfectly well-regulated economy. If you're obeying the rules in South Africa, you can trade globally. There's no real barrier to you. It's more about understanding the people, understanding the markets. The regulation, you can just pay a lawyer.
Sure.
One of the best things about regulation is written down.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry about regulation. Yeah. I'd worry about finding customers.
Yeah. One of the things that I think tends to be an impediment into global thinking is that when we think globally, especially us here in South Africa and perhaps in the rest of the African continent, we are already imagining Europe or the United States. Is there perhaps part of the thinking that needs to change that says, okay, when we think globally, we should also be thinking about part of the rest of the African continent and perhaps even other parts of the world, the East, the Far East? I mean, I just get a sense sometimes that whenever we think globally, and I don't know whether that's true for you in the UK, that when you think globally, you're thinking perhaps across the pond, the United States, or perhaps the rest of Europe. Is there a change in the way that you think about what globally means?
I would absolutely agree. There is a global war for talent, for really good people. It doesn't really matter where they come from. So it's really terribly important for any entrepreneur to think on a global scale. And that must include India, all of the rest of Asia, China.
Yeah.
Don't forget Japan. It has a phenomenal economy of its own. South America often gets forgotten.
Indeed.
People forget. But South America has vibrant economies. And Africa itself constantly surprises the Western audience or the Northern Hemisphere audience. When we look at the growth rates of countries like Kenya, Nigeria, Ethiopia, are phenomenal. Possibly explains why China pays such strong interest to East African economies. It's a very fast-growing place with great new emerging businesses. South Africa itself, you were talking earlier on your show about some of the sort of local political issues, but that doesn't take away from the fact you have a large, powerful, growing market.
And I suppose, David, that that sometimes is a problem in that we look at the political and economic sort of issues, and sometimes they sound negative in one part of the country or one part of the world. But I would imagine that an entrepreneur goes a little bit deeper. It doesn't just look at the politics and the economic issues of that country just from a news consumer's point of view, but also as one who's looking for an opportunity in that situation. So even if there may be an issue in, I don't know, whatever country, the entrepreneur looks at that and looks at it through the prism of what opportunities lie there rather than what partisan issues they are possibly preferring in that particular country.
It's terrifically important to think the way you just described. I really couldn't agree more. There's a very well understood metric that shows that companies formed in recession times tend to grow better, tend to be more resilient and grow faster when times are good. Ditto, or the same, applies to companies formed in difficult places. They grow better everywhere else. They're leaner, they're sharper, they're hungrier. So I would take a slightly philosophical approach, perhaps like most artists will say, without constraint, there is no art.
Yep.
And the constraint of your local market should be a way for you to sharpen your tools, to be better, just be better. And then once you own your little local market, no matter how small, it can be a village, it doesn't really matter, it can be a country, it can be a continent. Once you own that market, that is providing you with the fuel, the money to grow elsewhere. So don't overexpand, conquer your local market, get yourself profitable, and then reach out. That's really important. So if you have constraints or difficulties locally, use them to make you better. Yeah. Don't use them as an excuse to stop.
We have a debate here in South Africa that goes something like this. Let's worry about what goes on in the political sphere, in the economic sphere, because foreign investors might not want to invest. And then, of course, there's the other side of that conversation that says, well, foreign investors or domestic investors are only looking for a predictable sort of environment. They don't really care who wins or who loses. They just want a predictable business environment. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think we have our own problems. Where we have a nation which is busy trying to leave its biggest local market, or we have political issues with the current US administration. Everybody has local difficulties. What matters is the rule of law, the basic company structures, and the banking system and markets continue to function. If that's true, it doesn't really matter who's sitting in the chair. Don't tell them that, they don't like it. It really doesn't matter as much.
Of course,
it doesn't matter as much as they think.
Yeah.
The markets carry on because ultimately people want to eat, people want to go out, people want to drive their car, they want to have a good time, they want to talk to their friends, they want to wear nice clothes. Those things do not change, not very much.
Yeah.
Foreign direct investment, fine. If you can't get foreign direct investment, grow a lean startup using lean startup principles. The books are widely available, so there's no secret there. And that, apply that to anything from drying fish to the latest telecoms. The principles are the same. And if you have a market and you have a bank and you have a customer, it doesn't matter. Politics doesn't matter.
Sure. If I have a very technical business, maybe not technical in the very, very IT orientated sense, but a technical business in the sense that I'm a plumber or I'm a carpenter, right? And I suppose that's a certain level of technicality. And I am looking to become a global business. But my business has been largely successful because of what is happening regionally. What sort of things do I need to start thinking about in order to replicate what I'm doing here, and the very fact that my business has a particular nature. It is successful because of what is happening in that particular region. But I have aspirations of global presence. What should I be thinking about?
I would say three things very quickly. Protect your local market. Whatever you do, don't distract from your ability to make that market work for you, because that's providing the air in your lungs.
Yes.
So protect your local market first. Second, understand the next nearest market. So don't try and jump from Port Elizabeth to Shanghai.
Yeah.
Find your next available market and conquer that.
Yeah.
And you can probably walk there or take a bus or take a train and go and understand what's different about that market.
Yeah.
And change your product the least possible change to serve what they require. And when you've done that, do another one. And then you're training yourself to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Nobody's born an entrepreneur. Everybody has to learn. It's a skill. So, and then the third part of the puzzle would be ruthlessly gather data, information on how things sell, what sells, why, how do you make it, what are your costs, and become a data-driven business as you grow. So you can go from gut feel, your instinct, towards being a global companies must be data-driven. They must be driven by numbers, hard facts, and information.
Yeah.
But you can learn to do that one thing at a time.
Yeah.
One thing. So that those three things
sure.
will enable pretty much any business to scale. Conquer your local market, expand to the next available market, be driven by data.
When a business person who owns a typically technical business like I've just described, a plumbing company, the local electrician, the local a carpenter, usually the business is the person that owns it. In other words, his technical ability, his ability to put together a cupboard, to do whatever that is required technically, is the business. In other words, there's not somebody outside of the business who's also watching other people do the technical stuff. He is the business. How does somebody in that position with global aspirations. Yeah, how do you become the entrepreneur, the technical operator?
Well, I guess you the example to look at would be to read the biography of the IKEA family. I guess you have IKEA furniture.
Yeah.
There we go.
The Swedish.
So there's a guy that made furniture for himself. And now look at it. So absolutely, your example of a carpenter scales, and they scale by finding a market, finding the next market, and in this case, hiring really brilliant designers. And there's a whole thing that we could talk about design-led thinking, where you really make things that customers already want,
yeah,
but they don't know it yet.
Yeah, well, I remember Steve Jobs had a lot to say about that kind of thing, to say, look, we
design-led thinking, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, he's definitely an icon. And he made a few mistakes along the way.
Sure.
What a tiny part of his success, I would say, would be he surrounded himself. His first hires were superb, absolutely superb. The first five people were amazingly good. And he surrounded himself by people that could design for customers.
Yeah.
And Johnny Ives is continuing the trend. So if you're that carpenter making something that works locally and you're going to, say, the next town or the next country where styles are different and usage is different, get to know them and hire yourself somebody who can protect your market for you. So hire somebody that can carry on doing what you did as well as you did while you go to the next place.
Yeah.
And that'll work. That will scale. You will be able to grow. And I look forward to meeting my first South African furniture company in a main store in London, because I'd welcome it.
Sure. And is there a different mindset? I really believe that entrepreneurs are people with a specific mindset. Is there a mindset that you need to have in order for you to, you know, you've got regional or perhaps national entrepreneurs that are doing very, very well. But is there a specific mindset that an entrepreneur needs to develop? And what does he need to do practically in order to develop the global mindset, the mindset that says, okay, I know that I'm a South African businessman, but I've got to start thinking globally. What sort of ways of thinking does that person need to start learning, inculcating? Who does he need to go and have dinner with? What sort of mindset does he need to develop?
It's they say travel broadens the mind, and I couldn't agree more with that statement. You have to go. You have to travel. So that'd be the first command, if there was one: travel, go there. The second thing would be prepared to be lonely. Yeah. And learn to love your own company. Because you're going to spend a lot of time on the road alone. So if you're powerfully extroverted, you're going to find that first bit a little difficult. If you're powerfully introverted, you'll find the next thing difficult, which is you need to talk to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Invest in that. That's the cost of learning.
I asked that question, David, because I noticed that sometimes the psychological impediments come from not being exposed. In other words, if I don't travel enough, if I don't read enough, if I don't speak to as wide a group of people as possible, I tend to think that the world is my little world. And so the limitations that I experience in my little world, I start to think those are global limitations. But I also find that if you are speaking, as you're saying, to more people, to a wider audience, as it were, you start to realize that perhaps the rules of your little surroundings are just that, the rules of your little surroundings, that the world has got different rules by which they play.
Oh, most certainly. Although they tend to be remarkably similar, the differences are real but small, and there are lots of them. There's a certain maturity that I find in global entrepreneurs where they are happy to say they're wrong, hungry to learn what's different, and willing to travel. And when those three things come together, you generate some really powerful thinking. So let go of the assumption. You're aware of it, you know what it is. So the assumption is, as an example, I had a company that made computer games, and they had doors in the game, and the doors were designed in America, but they were drawn in India. When the doors came back, they were all wrong, because the guys in India thought all doors looked like heavily carved dark wood with paint on. And the guys in America did, but they looked like an American hotel door. So the difference was small but very important, and neither side was willing to let go of their assumptions. So be willing to learn, be willing to travel, and be willing to let go of your assumptions, because what you will find is truth and data, real hard facts. Having said that, though, all entrepreneurs have a certain amount of a sort of deal-doing mentality, the willingness to grab a deal or to take a deal. And that's kind of the last piece. That might be natural to whatever extent our psychology is natural as opposed to learned. So there is that kind of willingness to take a small risk for a big win.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that can be taught. I think that does tend to be quite natural in a person.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you are that person, it doesn't really matter whether you're working in a small local market in a small village on the coast, or whether you're in New York or Paris or Tokyo or Singapore. Those things come together and you will grow.
All right. On Twitter, Tsepo Matega says, to open a company that will dominate worldwide, you first have to determine common needs among the influential countries, e.g. the United States, the United Kingdom, China, Japan, etc. Secondly, you need to make sure that the need for that product is continuous. What would you say to that, Dave?
Well, continuous products are more profitable. So I would say if you can find one, do it. So your whoever can invent a new form of toilet paper will become extremely rich. That demand isn't going away. It's quite possible to sell into lots of small markets. You just have to make your manufacturing and distribution more efficient. Ultimately, though, at the end of the something simple and digital is easier to ship around the world than something physical. Something which is easy to make multilingual and multicultural is going to be cheaper to distribute. So the question, it comes back to the design thinking, to design the core of the heart of the product or service, design that in a way that really appeals to some universal human need, and then just make it the right color, shape, size for your local market. Those small changes, whether it's banking services, which they like to tell us it's terribly complicated, but actually banking is pretty straightforward. So once you strip away the artificial barriers, you can often find things that you can sell anywhere.
This person, D-Center from Joburg South, says, please make the podcasts of this current discussion with David available. This is profound. He says, a quick question for David, if I may. In terms of trade expansion, what is the philosophical point to consider between the socio-economic, psycho-political and psycho-economic trifactors? I don't even know what that means, David. Do you?
Well, I would struggle with it, to be honest. I think the three elements of that, there is a truth, I think, in those words, which is it's about the way people think. If you wish to be global, you have to think globally. So I guess that's the sort of psychological element. The economic arguments are about getting the money back from where you sell to where you manufacture.
Yeah.
So you could either shorten your money supply or you can shorten your supply chains. That's pretty straightforward. In terms of the last part of the psychology,
the psycho-economic marketing.
I'm not quite sure what that means. I'd hazard a guess, but I'd probably be wrong. I think there's an element of marketing is always local.
Yeah.
Ultimately, that's about the direct connection with your market in a way that they subconsciously, immediately understand meets their needs.
One of the things
I'm not sure I've answered that question. I hope so.
It's just a little bit above my sort of intellect, Dave. So I'm hoping that T-Sets understood you there. Let me ask you this question. You spoke about the company that you had where you you use the services of Americans in one level and Indians in another level. Is that perhaps part of the thinking that a global entrepreneur needs to have, to say that you may have to source different components of your goods or services from different parts of the world, and that you may have to be the assembler at some point that then provides the complete product? Or do you think in terms of putting together a manual that will allow people in any part of the world to be able to source different parts of this product and be able to put it together yourself? What is the thinking that the globally aspirant entrepreneur should have in terms of the availability of different components that appear or arise out of different parts of the world? What sort of thinking should there be in that sense, David?
Oh, it's enormously complicated, I'm afraid. Really. So most things can be sourced in most places. It's a question of degree, but some things are absolutely unique. So certain forms of semiconductors, certain minerals and so on, they're only available in a limited number of places. You have to go and get them. I think what we've seen in the world is a shift. We saw the post-Second World War era, everything made locally. I know it's pretty much a global phenomenon. Everything would have been made within a state or within a country and consumed. Then we saw the rise of exports. Then we saw the rise of outsourcing. So we would send things to be manufactured where the labor was cheapest.
Yeah.
And that happened, especially in India, China, still happening in China to some extent, now shifting into Malaysia, Indonesia, into Thailand. But I think we're already seeing the reversal of that. And whether we think Donald Trump is right or wrong, I probably shouldn't keep any such thinking. But the idea of pulling complete processes back into an individual nation seems to be underway. There's a kind of, I mean, some of it's protectionism,
yeah,
and some of it is just the tools are better. The software is better. The design is better. So that even if our labor isn't very cheap, we're just very good. And that saves time. And the world has found that there's a real cost in outsourcing. Africa never really benefited from outsourcing, which I think is a great tragedy because it could have done, but it didn't. But we've discovered around the world that outsourcing has an enormous cost in terms of management overheads. You have to supervise much better. And in terms of higher error rates and remediation, we have to fix too many things. So a lot of things have come back onshore, near shore. So in Europe, we bought things back from China and India, back into Eastern Europe, and then back into our home nations to some extent. America is well underway in quite a protectionist way of bringing things back onshore. So is there a right or wrong answer? No, I don't think there is. I think it changes. What I would say, though, is that technology, especially with automated manufacturing, makers, as the thing is, where you can have a machine that can assemble almost anything, with software-driven design, and with biotechnology, it doesn't matter where you are anymore. The raw materials are come in a bag, and the software can be sent over the air, over a telephone line.
Yeah.
So I think you will find, within 10 years, a lot more things made very locally. I think we'll see a reversal of global outsourcing, personally, with few exceptions, and semiconductors, because of the $1 billion costs of fab plants, as they're called, because of those massive costs, I think that's hard to reverse.
There has been, there's been talk, David, of globally regionalizing. Now, in other words, talk of saying, for example, that India, the subcontinent of India, is going to be the call center of the world, for example.
It has been for a long time.
You go. Certain parts of Africa are going to be the producers of food for the world, for example, or that a certain part of the United States, let's call it Silicon Valley, is going to be the innovator of certain technologies, together with is the world going in that trend? I mean, you've just acknowledged that India has become the call center of the world. But is that kind of regional concentration of capabilities, of abilities, is that the way the world is going?
I think it was, but my personal view, and this is informed only by observation, not by sort of rigorous scientific study, is that artificial intelligence and the rise of software will mean that things that have been a local monopoly, if we could call them that,
yep,
that were driven by labor costs, and in the case of India, English speaking, okay, that's the massive advantage that India has over China. Everybody speaks English to some extent.
Yep.
And so it became a call center because they're happy to stay up all night and service America on one clock and Europe on the other clock.
Yeah.
And they speak English, so it works very well. I think that will all pretty quickly, within 15 years, just be replaced by software. I think the idea of speaking to a human on the phone will be quaint very soon.
Yeah.
Whereas other things are natural monopolies. So sunlight, rain, and soil, if you wish to grow food, yeah, I think Africa has a phenomenal future. It also has creativity, art, music, culture, minerals. So it has a lot of other things that it hasn't even begun to explore. For instance, pharmaceuticals. My question to Africa is, why isn't Africa the world center of pharmaceuticals? So Africa and South America have all the biodiversity.
Yeah.
All the good new drugs should come from those places. So some things have natural monopolies or natural advantages, but I think a lot of the things we see today will wash away. And software will change. Software eats the world.
Finally, Dave, I mean, I've found this conversation quite fascinating. Finally, the fact that you've got to have all of these considerations that we've been talking about for the last hour if you want to be a global business, is there a case for saying perhaps you shouldn't be thinking globally? As a business person, as an entrepreneur, that perhaps you should focus on the regional character of your business?
I'm an enormous fan of diversity, whether it's diversity of gender, race, or anything. So I think diversity carries a premium. It might be slightly harder to market initially. Global markets are very accepting of a degree of diversity. So I would always say to somebody, capture your local market first. Then you've got somewhere to fall back. That's your castle. That's your fortress.
Yeah.
That's the thing that keeps you going. Right? Capture that first. Don't wake up tomorrow morning and decide to become a global business and just launch yourself into a series of flights out of Africa and around the world.
Yeah.
Because I think you'll be setting out an extraordinarily painful and uncertain path.
Yeah.
Catch your local regional market. Be strong. Learn and then move and then grow. Grow globally by following those three basic principles. Improve your own diversity of thinking. The other thing I would say that we haven't touched on is I don't think there's any such thing as an entrepreneur on their own. Yeah. Every good entrepreneur has been in a team.
David, I want to thank you. Thank you very much for yes, for sure. David, I want to thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the advice that you've given us, and hope to talk to you again sometime soon.
I would really appreciate it. I have really greatly enjoyed your question. Very insightful. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. David J.W. Bailey is an entrepreneur and a business advisor. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll take the news and then we get to talking.